This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. With just under 5 weeks to go before the 20th Winter Olympics commence, there is already controversy dimming, if not shrouding, Turin 2006. Here to talk about the U.S. skeleton sled team and other quadrennial matters is the Boston Globe's John Powers. John, welcome back.
Thank you, Bill.
Last Saturday, skeleton coach Tim Nardiello was placed on paid administrative leave by the United States Bobsled and Skeleton Federation, and he was not allowed to travel with the team for this week's World Cup races in Germany. Allegations by three female athletes include inappropriate touching and comments over the course of Nardiello's tenure. Why did Tristan Gale, Felicia Canfield, and another unnamed sledder wait until just before the Olympics to come forward with these charges?
Well, that's what's very unclear here. And if you talk to the contenders for this team, they write it off to sour grapes. They say, here were women who weren't going to make the team and weren't happy about it and basically decided to cost this guy his job now. And I think that will be critical to the two investigations. Not only is USA Bobsled and Skeleton doing their investigation, the U.S. Olympic Committee is doing theirs, because the issue here is not just whether he will keep his job, but whether Nardiello can be an Olympic coach, and he can be one and not the other.
As you suggest, the public support has come from the athletes who are going to make the team. It's split pretty much down that line. Those who have made it or are going to make it support the coach. Those who didn't, don't.
That's right. And I think that's what makes this an unusual situation, is that normally when there are coach-athlete issues, they're about the coach of the team and the athletes on that team. In this case, this has no relevance to the athletes who will be sliding in Turin. But what is quite possible is that you might have different interpretations of what Nardiello did or didn't do or say.
Do you have any sense of how this is going to come out?
My hunch is that the USOC will look at it very differently. I think they don't want a mess in Turin. They are used to having messes at the Olympic Games at the worst possible time, and clearly they would like to clear this up before they leave. I think if it is clear that this is behavior in the past that may have been addressed since, that Nardiello will be okay. If it's recent behavior, that is something very different.
Is it going to have an effect? Is this controversy going to have an effect on who is actually competing in the Olympics? Is that still somewhat up for grabs, or has that already been determined?
No, actually, next week is fairly critical, because the number of sliders each country will have will be dependent on how they're doing on the overall nation standings. And if the Americans are in the top three, right now they're fourth, they will get two. So right now they only have one slider. So if you believe that Nardiello's presence is going to make a difference for the women's team, then it would be critical that he be there and that the U.S. be able to have two sliders.
In figure skating, Michelle Kwan will attempt to take the Nancy Kerrigan route to Olympic glory. That's not quite a fair comparison, because nobody disabled Michelle Kwan, but she did have some injuries. What do you think? What are her chances?
Well, I think if Michelle shows that she can be reasonably competitive by the time of Turin, then I think they will put her on the team. I mean, no one certainly has a better resume. No one deserves it more. And the other little irony here is the last time a skater was put on, Nancy, after wounded knee, the bumpee was Michelle Kwan. She mm-hmm. handled it very well.
She
went as an alternate.
Because, right.
Exactly. So I think there's a feeling. But the problem with Michelle is she hasn't competed at an Olympic-level competition since last year's World Championships. She didn't do very well there. And I think the issue is, do you want her on the team if she's going to be sixth? And I think when we talked to Michelle the other day, she said, if I'm not 100%, I won't go.
You say she's going to have to demonstrate that she's 100%, but she's bailed out of next week's U.S. Women's Figure Skating Championships. What would be her opportunity between now and Turin to demonstrate that she was fit?
Well, actually, this 1 year, unusually, there is a competition after the Nationals and before the Olympics. What used to happen was, in Todd Eldridge, he was put on the team with a bad back. Judges come up and monitor your skating and make you do the programs, and they make a decision. In this case, the Four Continents competition is going to be in Colorado Springs at the end of January, just a couple of days before the roster deadline. My hunch is they'll say, Michelle, go to Four Continents. If you skate well enough there, you'll be on the team. Otherwise, the alternate's going to go.
Who is the favorite in St. Louis to take this week's U.S. Women's Michelle Kwan, not their figure skating championships?
Everyone's favorite, of course, is Sasha Cohen, who has finished second four times. No woman has ever finished second five times at the U.S. National.
Buffalo of figure skating.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, what's interesting is Sasha has beaten Michelle at the last two World Championships, but this is certainly her year. If not now, when?
John, in a 60 Minutes interview that will air tomorrow, U.S. skier Bodie Miller apparently described the difficulties of skiing while intoxicated. It doesn't surprise me that that would be difficult, but I was unaware that the Winter Olympics had a drunken downhill category.
Well, this does give a whole new meaning to the word Miller time. And I look back now how often we have written, Bodie Miller hammered his way down the course.
Oh, we didn't know how true it was, yes.
Actually, I think many people will now give him more credit rather than less.
The Canadian women's hockey team lost to the U.S. women's hockey team the last time they played before the Olympics. That would seem to have given the U.S. team the psychological advantage. And then the U.S. women's team lost to a boys' high school team the other day.
That's right.
Do they go in confident or dubious?
Reasonably confident. You know, it's very interesting if you go back to 1960 with the men's team that won the gold medal. The turnaround for them was when they lost to a men's amateur team from the same town, Warroad, Minnesota. And they said, we can't have this. What's interesting, actually, is a boys' high school team is fairly competitive with the top women in the world with size and speed. I think the Americans' issue was going to be they play one game at the Olympics. The only game that matters is against Canada. And in the past, it's been good to lose to your opponent all the way up in the exhibitions. For example, the Americans hammered the Canadians last time in the lead-up and then lost the gold medal. So this way, it may turn out the other way.
How should we refer to this year's host city, Turin or Torino?
Well, I think if you are Italian, it is Torino, but then it's also Roma, Venezia, Livorno. I prefer to say it is a Detroit with castles.
John Powers records ringish exploits for the Boston Globe. He'll cover the faster, the higher, the stronger for only a game in Turin, or Torino, if you like, in just a few weeks. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
The Big East Basketball Conference is now the 16-team Bigger East, thanks to the arrival of five schools from Conference USA. Big East fixtures Villanova, undefeated so far this season, and UConn, with only one loss, are the favorites to win the league title. But as Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports, newcomer Louisville, at 11-2 and coming off a Final Four appearance last year, could be one as well.
Louisville men's basketball coach Rick Pitino says that joining the Big East Athletic Conference wasn't his idea.
I came in here thinking Conference USA is where we're going to be, and all of a sudden we're in the Big East. And I would have said we're going to be in the Big East someday. Now, for football, it's awesome. I mean, we can win a potential national championship, go to a BCS bowl, and it's great.
Louisville's up-and-coming football team just finished the season ranked 19th in the AP national poll. But the 8th-ranked basketball team is just beginning its run, along with former Conference USA partners Marquette, Cincinnati, DePaul, and South Florida, through a Big East gauntlet that contains 6 of the country's top 30 teams. Moreover, Louisville entered this season with 10 freshmen and sophomores. They have only one returning starter, senior guard Tyquan Dean, who helped the Cardinals make it to the Final Four last year. Eric Crawford, who covers the team for the Louisville Courier-Journal, says they may be in for a rude awakening.
Not only are they playing 2 games against Connecticut, 2 against Villanova, 2 against Cincinnati, their road games, through the luck of the draw, were at Syracuse, at West Virginia, at some of the tougher venues. So they are really going to be taxed in this season, and it's going to be a different experience for fans here who are going to take more conference losses than they're used to, and it'll be interesting to see how everybody here adjusts.
For now, longtime fans like Phil Levy and Judy Lindsay are looking forward to seeing bigger name teams at Freedom Hall, and they're expecting the hometown Cardinals to rise to the occasion.
It's going to be more competitive, better quality basketball, and you get better by playing better teams. And I think the Big East has the best.
Well, we had a lot of good competition in the USA, but I just think that, you know, these teams are more nationally known than the ones we played before. It matters to me as a fan and a big U of L fan because it's going to help the school also.
Despite Louisville's loss to number 3-ranked Villanova Thursday night, the newcomers to the conference are already making waves. Earlier in the week, Marquette upset 2nd-ranked UConn. Pitino, who once coached Providence in the Big East, says there's room at the top for the Cardinals.
I don't think anybody knows who's good and who's not. In other words, I know Villanova and Connecticut have a good chance at a Final Four and potential national championship. But then there's about 12 other teams that don't know if they're going to be left out of the dance or they're going to go to the dance, and we're one of those teams. We're just painfully young, but I think we have potential.
Although Louisville has been prone to defensive lapses and scoring droughts early in the season, Tyquan Dean has provided the offense with almost 17 points a game. Sophomores David Padgett and Juan Palacios and junior Brandon Jenkins have each averaged better than 11 points. And adds the Courier-Journal's Crawford, don't underestimate the role of Patino, who quickly turned around a team that in 2001 had finished 12-19, and it cost Louisville legend Denny Crum his head coaching job.
This was a proud program before he arrived, but I think if you look at the infrastructure of it, he's raised a tremendous amount of money. He came in, he immediately put his fingerprints all over the facilities, new locker rooms. He put in the trophy case where there are already two national championship trophies. He put a third one that says reserved for Louisville's next national championship. And then he went to work on the players in their physical conditioning and all of his trademarks of things that he does as a coach.
In Patino's first year, the Cardinals won 19 games, followed by two 20-win seasons. Last year's 33-5 record included Louisville's first Final Four appearance in almost two decades. That is the kind of success to which Rick Pitino has been accustomed. After winning a national title in 1996 with in-state rival Kentucky, he jumped to the NBA's Boston Celtics, where his career as the highly paid coach and team president was widely seen as a huge failure. Louisville athletic director Tom Jurich says that luring Pitino back to the state of Kentucky has turned into a win-win situation.
You know, I'm not sure I can explain it, but what I will say is I think he's got a great comfort zone in college. He's doing a lot more teaching there. He's dealing with 18, 19, 20-year-olds that really absorb a lot of his teaching and really take on a lot of his knowledge. And I think that's really been a benefit for us.
Pitino says his experience with losing teams in Boston taught him patience, which he admits he'll need with this year's inexperienced Louisville squad. The Cardinals play at Pitino's old haunt, Providence, tonight. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Louisville, Kentucky.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, this golfing life, no danger of it being mine. But first, the National Football League's playoff season gets underway today and continues tomorrow. A weekend's worth of games will eliminate four of the teams clinging to Super Bowl dreams. Joining me on the line now is Paul Attner of the Sporting News. He carries me each time we talk about the NFL on Only a Game. Paul, welcome back.
Bill, I'll caddy for you anytime.
I'm happy to hear it. And I have a surprise question or several for you this week. Are you ready?
No.
I'm going to give them to you anyway. Can the right side of the Bengals' offensive line properly seal off its protection against the Steelers? Or, wait, should the Jaguars run a quarterback platoon of David Garrard and Byron Leftwich against the Patriots? Or will Washington's defensive backfield recover from the potential loss of cornerback Sean Springs? Who's going to replace his hip swivel?
Man, my mind is a flutter with all your knowledge here. This is impressive.
Seriously, though, and the NFL must, of course, remain serious at all times, there are two wildcard games today, the first pitting the aforementioned Washingtons against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. A rematch of one of the more exciting regular season games. Do they have another great game?
I think it's certainly an evenly matched game, and yeah, I think it has the potential for being a pretty good one. The first game, Redskins still have some bitterness about. They felt that, guess what, the officials made a bad call. I mean, you know, how many times you hear that one? And now, you know, they just need to go out there and not put it in the officials' hands. So it's nice to see Joe Gibbs back in the playoffs. He came back last season, looked like he didn't know how to coach anymore. This season certainly shown that he still can, and it adds to the NFL's aura, I think, to have, you know, this old guy still advanced age, able to coach with youngsters like John Gruden, you know, among the youngest coaches in the league.
Kind of carries on the tradition established by college football in the postseason
exactly.
This time around with Joe Paterno.
Exactly. It's still, you know, the game hasn't passed the bye, I guess. God, I hate that cliche.
Tonight, the defending champion New England Patriots face the Jacksonville Jaguars. The speculation in Boston was that the Patriots may have, tanked their last game so they could play the Jaguars instead of the Steelers. If it's true, was it a wise choice?
Well, sure. I mean, I don't think it was. They tank it in this way. The coach removes their best players. Now, you know, if that's tanking, you know, more power to him. He should have got his best players out there. If that leads to the setup, that's fine. I have no problem with that. And, yeah, the Jags, they have a gaudy record, but not a really that good of a team. And they're, I think, the weakest of the AFC playoff field, which, by the way, is a really, really good one, as good as it's been in a long time. And so they picked a little bit of, a patsy to be here. And what kills me about the Patriots, they're using this, you know, we're getting disrespected and all this stuff. I mean, they've won two titles in a row.
And three out of four.
Yeah, I just love the psychological poise of coaches and players. Yeah, the Patriots are disrespected. Everybody fears the Patriots. I guarantee in this league right now, they're scared as heck to play the Patriots.
Did you enjoy Doug Flutie's drop kick for an extra point last weekend?
Yeah, it was terrific, wasn't it? I mean, that's just, of all things, from Bill Belichick. I mean, Mr. Laughs, you know? I mean,
absolutely.
That one is like, wow, you know, did he actually let him do that? I mean, it was nice because, you know, Belichick does have a feel for the history of the game. I mean, because the game, he's obsessed with it. And, you know, he knows how rare that's been the 40 years or so since it happened. And it was nice to see. And I'm sure there was an astonishing number of people in the TV and live crowd that said, what is a dropkick? they had no clue what was going on.
So what do we get in this weekend's action? The return of the single wing and the leather helmet?
We can only hope. I was just thinking, when you mentioned earlier about the Jaguars, maybe we have rotating quarterbacks. That used to happen on a few teams, too, and the NFL would go, oh, my God, rotating quarterbacks, how can we do that?
Tomorrow, the Cincinnati Bengals make their long-awaited return to the playoffs against division rival Pittsburgh. Bengals wide receiver Chad Johnson has become either famous or notorious, depending on your point of view, for his elaborate and often silly and just as often delightful touchdown celebrations. Do we see more performance art on Sunday?
Oh, I think so. I think it's going to be a high enough scoring game for Chad to get in the end zone a few times, and I hope he does because, you know, I've talked about this in the past. I'm not a real big fan of celebrations, of the contrived stuff, but this guy is an original, harmless things that give you a chuckle. And as long as he can keep it in that area and doesn't, you know, start doing crazy stuff, I enjoy it. And I hope he does get in the end zone. But, you know, if he doesn't, the Steelers win because the Bengals need to score a lot of points. In a low-scoring game, it plays right into what the Steelers want. And the Bengals need to generate, you know, in the 30s, I think, for them to be able to win this one.
All right, I hate to admit it, Paul, and I'm sure no one has noticed, but my considerable well of football knowledge has about run dry. I can't think of a reason why we should watch the New York Giants and the Carolina Panthers tomorrow. Help me out.
Well, we want to see if Tom Coughlin can suffer on the sidelines. That's my enjoyment. He may pull more faces in agony than any coach I've seen. I mean, more than even Gruden. It's just Tom suffers. Boy, does he really suffer. And with that team, he's done some suffering. I mean, they've been pretty inconsistent. It's going to be really, it's a pretty good matchup, Bill. I mean, they're pretty even teams have shown great ability at some points during the season and at other points depths of how to go about botching games. And that's going to be what determines this thing, which team can be the more consistent of the two for one afternoon. They're both really talented, but I think that inconsistency is ultimately going to get both teams beat in the playoffs.
The winners this weekend will advance to next week's divisional playoffs, where number one seeds Seattle and Indianapolis will be waiting. Is there any chance that either of those teams don't make it to their respective conference championships?
No, I'm glad you said conference champions, not Super Bowls, because, yeah, there's a great chance that one of the two won't. It has been since 1993 that that we've seen both top seeds make it to the Super Bowl, and that's a pretty astonishing number. That's a long, long time. But I think both these teams, because of home field and because the pattern has been that the top seeds usually win their first home game, I think the odds are pretty good they're both going to get there. And, you know, Seattle particularly is the class of their conference. Indy's very good, but they've got such a difficult number of opponents they have to play. You know, it's going to be harder for them, although I expect both teams to be playing in the conference finals.
Paul Lattner writes about football for the Sporting News and tolerates my tentative forays into his game. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Bill. Look forward to that golf game.
For over 20 years, Michael Bamberger has been writing about golf for various publications, most recently for Sports Illustrated. He is given to saying of his first home golf course such things as, "It reminds me of my dreams." In a new book, This Golfing Life, Atlantic Monthly Press has collected some of Bamberger's best work. Michael Bamberger joins me now from WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Adjectives like pastoral are often applied to golf, no surprise there, but so are adjectives such as mystical and spiritual. Why?
I go there with some reluctance. I know a lot of golfers do, and I understand it. My own high school golf coach, who was from Peabody, Mass., and was, you know, a working-class kid who found his way to golf, made a hole-in-one shortly before he died and had his ashes cremated on the very place where he made the hole-in-one. And lately, I find myself thinking about what I want to do in the hereafter, and I can imagine doing the same myself. There's a lot of religious symbolism associated with golf. I think for a lot of us, our church or our temple is as much the golf course as it is anything with four walls and a roof.
Of course, the other side of the golf coin, the other side from pastoral and mystical and spiritual, historically hasn't been so pretty. When you were up for membership at the Philadelphia Cricket Club, which is in fact a golf club rather than a cricket club, one of the members said to you, "It'll be interesting to see what the admissions committee does with a Center City Jew." Were you ever discouraged by the presence of this sort of attitude regarding Jews or blacks or women in golf?
One could be, but I've chosen to take another view, which is that if, you know, those of us with open minds try to beat down the walls and get into these institutions, we can improve them and make them more open and make them realize that, you know, they can still have their snapper soup, you know, even if there's a collection of Asian, Jewish, and black golfers, you know, at the table next door. And a lot of that has diminished over time and will continue to as our society changes.
In one chapter, you refer to a golf pro in Scotland named John Stark, and he said to you that when Ben Hogan came to play in the British Open in 1953 at Carnoustie, quote, "Scottish golf took a mortal blow." I've never heard Ben Hogan's achievement referred to in just those terms. What did Mr. Stark mean?
Stark meant that the clinical obsession that Hogan had with the golf swing was not anything like the usual way that the Scots were accustomed to playing the game, literally for centuries. The Scots were all about getting the ball in the hole, and how you looked doing it didn't particularly matter. Hogan was probably the first person to obsessively study every point in the golf swing and say, if you can get all these points perfect, then the swing will be perfect. If the swing is perfect, then the shots will be perfect. That was eye-opening to the Scots. So when he came over to play the Open Championship, as the rest of the world refers to the British Open, they had never seen anything like it. And on the four consecutive days of the competition, he played the golf course with a clinical precision that they weren't accustomed to. And the joke was that, you know, he was playing out of the same divot marks day after day, although it must have been a joke because Carnoustie in 1953 had no divots because it was, you know, so rock hard. And then Stark, my Scottish mentor, got so swept up in it that he became a clinician himself, and he got very interested in high-speed photography and trying to break down the swing into all these little components. And then in his later years, when I met him when he was probably 70, he went back to the golf of his Scottish boyhood and rediscovered and taught me to rethink of the game as a game and with the goal of, you know, it's a cross-country game in which you try to get the ball into the hole in the fewest shots possible.
Michael, regarding Al Geiberger, who won a PGA championship almost 40 years ago, you write that, quote, "he was aware of other people," and go on to say, "among elite athletes, that's not a common trait." Why do you suppose that's so?
Well, all sports at the highest level, and in golf particularly, regards a sort of monomaniacal dedication to improving one's self. You know, there's the famous story of Hogan playing a practice round with Claude Harmon, Butch Harmon's father. Butch Harmon's the former teacher of Tiger Woods. Mm-hmm. And Harmon makes a hole-in-one, and then Hogan hits it to 8 feet, wherever the distance, one holes the putt, and coming off the green says, "I do believe that's the first two I ever made on this hole," you know, completely disregarding the fact that his playing partner has just made a hole-in-one. But, you know, that level of self-absorption, although that's an extreme example, is sort of characteristic.
In one of my favorite passages in the book, you're writing about an LPGA tournament to which you took your daughter and her friend. Would you read just a bit from that essay, please?
Sure. The girls, notebooks in hand, polled spectators to determine the most popular golfer in the field. There were 11 votes for Sorenstam, one vote for Meg Mallon, and one vague vote for Kim, a name that appeared 6 times on the draw sheet, but only once as a first name, by my daughter Alina's count. Lorena Ochoa flipped her ball to Lisa coming off the 15th green. It signed it for her with a red Sharpie after her round. One vote for Lorena. Alina asked me one especially endearing question. Why are your drives longer than the ladies' players' drives? She knew nothing about my 91.2 stroke average or the crookedness of my tee shots. Have I said anything about the pleasures of having a daughter? Alina and Lisa watched Sorenstam reel off a string of birdies and take over the tournament, setting up her 7th major win. They saw a legend at the peak of her powers, Roger Maris in 61, when he hit 61. They met the great Betsy King. The Hall of Famer shook their bony little hands and said, "Hello, girls." Walking to the car, Lisa announced that she wants to become a journalist when she grows up. After the golf, we stopped at the charcoal pit and got burgers to go and ate them on the road. In my rearview mirror, I saw the future of the game sitting in the back seat, licking the ketchup off their lips and singing with the windows rolled all the way down.
You compare writing to playing golf at one point in the book, in This Golfing Life, and I think that last sentence is a long, curling putt that drops into the hole with a very satisfying tock.
It's very kind. Thank you.
In an essay toward the end of the book, you discuss what has changed in the world of professional golf since you first went out and carried a bag for a touring pro years ago. What's better about the pro game, and what's not as good as it used to be?
Well, interesting question. A lot of different ways to think about it. I mean, there's less charm in the game now than there used to be. On the professional tours, the players are certainly less colorful. In Trevino's day and Hogan's day, and long before that, which I'm less familiar with, most of the caddies came out of the caddy yard. I mean, it sounds like a cliche to say, but it really is true. Professional golf, there were two ways to find your way to golf in those days, and that one was either to be from a wealthy enough family where you had access to the game, or for the great majority of the professionals, they found their way to the game by working in the game as kids or as caddies or something else. And so that generation was less polished. Many fewer had college educations. And today, most of the golfers on the PGA Tour come out of some upper middle class or higher background. Grew up in a suburban development where there was a golf course attached to the development where they lived, and there is a certain more of a robotic quality. But how golf plays in your mind, the toll it takes on the psyche. I'm laughing because I realize that this sounds crazy to someone who's not a golfer, but it really does. You know, the 6 feet to win. To somebody who doesn't know golf, it looks like, I've made many 6-foot putts, playing mini golf. What's the big deal? It isn't a big deal until it's 6 feet to win a U.S. Open, and then it's a really big deal. And we've seen Retief Goosen and Stuart Sink and other great golfers over the years just gag and throw up all over themselves trying to make these putts. That fundamental part of the game doesn't change. And I think that's a lot of why I know always love writing about the game, because it will always be, it's a game of that takes tremendous physical prowess to play at a high level, and ultimately it's a game that requires a lot of mind over matter.
Michael Bamberger is the author of This Golfing Life, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. He joined me from WHYY in Philadelphia. Michael, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks for finding your way to this book. I really appreciate it.
Everybody had a golf course, no work would get done. Just an endless summer, filled with fun, fun, fun. Doctor's office is empty, no getting sick today. Every day would be Wednesday, golfing USA.
To send comments about what you've heard on Only a Game, rifle through our voluminous audio archives, or see what our cameras capture when we're in the field, please visit onlyagame.org.
Take a fall against sand drops, they lose each other's trust. And at the end of the day, you hit. hate each other's guts. Yeah, you'd pick three good buddies and get a foursome going. Spend the day together out on the course golfing. Take a mulligan's and drop, then lose each other's trust.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont on the...
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the symbiotic relationship between pro wrestling and yoga as manifested in one gem of an athlete. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a conversation about the week's news. Happy New Year, Charlie.
Happy New Year, Bill. I'm finding my bliss and it's wearing a feather boa.
I'm sorry to hear that. Does your life seem more orderly now because there is no argument about which college football team is the national champion?
Well, I don't know about that, but that game sure was a lot of fun. And I'll tell you something very interesting after having watched that game and having watched Vince Young play against Michigan the year before.
Mm-hmm.
I could care less how good a pro he is. I'm serious. I saw one guy make one of the best teams in college football history look like children at the biggest moments.
When they all tried to tackle him.
And they couldn't catch him, and
right.
They couldn't find him, and
right.
His instincts were perfect. If he never plays a down in the NFL, I'm a Vince Young fan.
Following the game, UT students back in Austin celebrated by singing "The Eyes of Texas Are Upon You" and by chanting "Vince Young for President." What happened to the traditions of celebrating by setting cars on fire and getting arrested?
Well, I don't know, but if we have to have a president from Texas, I'm perfectly willing to trade the one we have for Vince Young at this point. No, Austin's a terrific place. Austin, to me, is the greatest college town in America, edging out Madison, Wisconsin at the wire. Apparently, there was no real trouble. There was a lot of fun. They lit up the famous Texas Tower. One 21-year-old junior named Robert Schneider told the Associated Press, "This is the best thing that ever happened to Austin. This is the best that ever happened to me!"
In my life. I love it. Another of the bowl games worth mentioning is the Orange Bowl. Was there ever better proof that in sports there are not only second chances, but third chances as well, at least for guys who are trying to kick field goals?
Well, if your livelihood depends on teenage field goal kickers, yes, you can have a second and third and fourth chance if you're very lucky. Of course, the story of the Orange Bowl was Bobby Bowden and Joe Paterno in what ought to be their coaching dotas, putting together a couple of teams that played each other very, very well. You know, you had the guy come back, the kicker from Penn State come back to win the game. You had the Florida State kicker hitting the upright. I mean, it was just this extraordinary contest, and then it was completely obliterated by the Rose Bowl the next night.
Back in 2003, Ohio State was the national champion, thanks in large part to the efforts of Maurice Claret. This is a guy who probably wishes he could turn the clock back.
Well, certainly back to before the summer of 2003 when a car he had borrowed from a local dealership had gotten broken into and he found out that he had lost more than $10,000 in stuff he shouldn't have had more than $10,000 of if he was a student-athlete. Yeah, he is now in the hands of the criminal justice system and not likely to get out anytime soon. As heinous as it is to commit a crime, it really does look like one of those cry-for-help crimes. He opened his coat, showed the people a gun, and took a cell phone. I suspect Maurice Claret will be popping up in the news, sadly, for the next couple of years, every 6 months or so.
Jack Abramoff, the former lobbyist who will be helping prosecutors build cases against various legislators from now until roughly the 12th of never, often involved games in his wheeling and dealing, Charlie. Among the gifts that he gave legislators and others were Super Bowl tickets, golf trips to Scotland, and luxury suites at various athletic contests. I wonder, should Commissioners Tagliabue, Stern, and Selig at all be worried?
I wouldn't be at all surprised if somebody from the leagues wound up testifying in this case. I wouldn't be at all surprised if the abbot of a monastery full of Carthusians in Kentucky gets called into this trial. As far as I know, every single piece of American currency produced by a U.S. mint in the last 50 years has gone through this guy's fingertips at one point or another. My favorite Jack Abramoff story, though, out of this whole thing is the fact that actually, I have a couple. The first one is that he was disqualified from running for the presidency of his middle school class because he went past the spending limit. according to the principal. Yeah, I just figured he probably had, like, his own picnic table at Little League games, and he brought people in and served them food and stuff. And the second one was that he apparently was a high school weightlifting champ, which is good because he's going to be spending a lot of time in a place where a lot of people lift weights.
Among weightlifters. Alex Rodriguez, who late last year said that he didn't want to offend anybody by choosing either the Dominican Republic or the U.S. as the team that he would play for in the upcoming World Baseball Classic, has now chosen the U.S. Do I hear the sound of Dominicans shouting, que bueno, que bueno?
They probably do, but I don't know what that means.
That means great. Let them have him.
I don't know. You had a feeling that Alex Rodriguez's ego was not going to allow him to be left out of this thing entirely, and since it was unlikely that they were going to allow him to start his own country and be the president, which was pretty much the only thing Alex would go for, that he would probably come down on the side of not offending the United States, where he makes all his millions of dollars.
On Thursday, the AP named Sean Alexander its most valuable player. In what sport exactly?
That would be the National Football League of American Football. Oh. And I know we're rounding into the playoffs, Bill, and I know...
I should be paying attention.
Well, I know, it's just I'm not going to be able to get your attention for the next 3 weeks till the Super Bowl is over. But Sean Alexander is, of course, you know, playing for the Seattle Seahawks, given where they're playing and the love that network television shows them. He might as well be playing on Pluto. He's had a terrific year. Peyton Manning was second. This is not a surprise. Tom Brady, who I would have had my vote, considering he picked the New England Patriots up and carried them for 4 or 5 days. Not to say that it wouldn't be good for my ongoing project, too, but that's neither here nor there. Finished third. That is the
product placement.
In that order, those are the three most valuable players. I certainly don't have a complaint with Sean Alexander.
People who enjoy voting for ex-athletes may soon have another opportunity to do so, at least if they live in Pennsylvania. Charlie, how do you feel about the possibility of Governor Lynn Swann?
Well, first of all, he's probably not going to get the nomination because there are four other candidates. Second of all, he has no qualifications. Third of all, the Republican Party in Pennsylvania is in disarray. They're going to lose Senator Rick Santorum. They're desperately searching around for anybody. Lynn Swann's platform, I think, basically is, I used to catch passes from Terry Bradshaw, and now I hang around the sidelines a lot. I think it'd be only fair, though, if they put John Stallworth in there in the Democratic Party so he could take some of the coverage away from Lynn, since that's what he did his entire career.
This week, the National Football League fined Atlanta Falcons coach Jim Mora $25,000 for using his cell phone on the sidelines during December 24th game against Tampa Bay. A fair punishment?
Well, not according to Joe Horn, who used his in an end zone celebration, was fined $30,000, and he's demanding that the punishment fit the crime. He wants the coach fined $30,000, too.
Either that or he gets $5,000 back. And finally, Charlie, you will no doubt recall that shortly after the 2005 Major League Soccer season ended, the San Jose Earthquakes relocated to Houston. And now a contest is underway to name that Houston team. Have you a favorite among the candidates or perhaps a suggestion of your own?
Well, actually, there are a number of good ones. The Houston Apollos, of course, because of the space program. The Houston Buffaloes, or the Buffalo Houstons, if they have to move again. Who knows?
It's like the Buffalo Springfield.
The Houston Americans, which is very generic and can be used whenever the MLS decides to move this team again. But my favorite is the Houston 1836, because, by God, we don't have enough sports teams that sound like they're named after a bottle of blended whiskey.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Last week's Best of Only a Game show included the conversation I had several months ago with author Dave Zirin. Mr. Zirin blamed George Marshall, the man who used to own the NFL's Washington franchise, for naming the team the Redskins. In fact, as Rick Ludwig pointed out in an email, that was the name of the team when Mr. Marshall bought it and moved it to Washington. For the December 24th edition of Only a Game, I visited with a former racehorse named Rudy, who'd been adopted by a family in Littleton, Massachusetts, through the efforts of an organization called Canter. That story led Amy Johnson, a WBUR listener, to email as follows. It was wonderful to hear a sports program talk about the negative side of the horse racing industry and to offer a way to help those horses. On the 24th, I also referred to performances by the U.S. men's Olympic ice hockey teams in Nagano and Salt Lake City as debacles. Sarah Riegel, who hears Only a Game on WCBE in Columbus, Ohio, wrote, "While Nagano was obviously a debacle for U.S. hockey, I don't see how Salt Lake City could be. A team that was already being seen as over the hill played well and won the silver. Point taken, Ms. Riegel." In response to our story about defunct college bowl games, Bob Peck, who served as athletic director at Williams College and before that at Boston University, called with an anecdote from his BU days, illustrating an ordering of priorities not so common in big-time college sports today.
We got offered the Boardwalk Bowl game in Atlantic City. but it was right during our exam period, and I just right out of hand turned it down. Today, it's an exam period. We don't go to bowl games in exam period. Well, that came out that I had just turned down the first bowl game that BU had been offered to, maybe ever or in a long time. And then I guess people were a little unhappy with me for making that decision, but I thought, hey, that's the way you do things in college athletics. That was my philosophy.
We've recently received several questions about the music on Only a Game. All music information is now available on our website, onlyagame.org. But hey, Ronald Davidoff, WFCR listener, I'm going to go ahead and tell you that I'm Aurelian is from a CD entitled It Makes Sense by Kieran and Cameron, presumably Raelians, if not necessarily bowlers. You can leave a message on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. Our surface mail address is WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. And again, the easiest way to reach us is through the website, onlyagame.org.
I don't take coffee, don't take drugs, my dear. Got a boyfriend on the side. You can see it if you trace it from my birth. I'm a alien on planet Earth. You can find me almost anywhere. You'll know me by my smile.
Pro wrestling has nothing in common with yoga, you say to yourself. Oh yeah, think again, rebuts Arizona Public Radio's Jillian Ferris Cole, who has this profile of a man not afraid of either discipline.
Diamond Dallas Page is 6'4" with bulging biceps. He's covered in tattoos and his pectoral muscles are Herculean. He looks entirely too massive to contort himself into advanced yoga postures. But somehow, he gracefully moves through a series of poses on a sunny patch of grass next to the jacuzzi at his Southern California condo.
And then back into a push-up, and then I'll do a 10-second push-up, holding the 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, bang, hold for 10. And from there, I'll go into the Jack LaLanne. This is a balancing pose. But when you've blown your shoulders up, this is a shoulder workout when you're doing elbow, forearm, handstands.
Diamond Dallas Page, or DDP as he's known to legions of wrestling fans, turns his massive frame upside down and balances on shoulders the size of boulders. It's quite a feat considering DDP could barely walk a few years ago. Back inside his condo, over freshly squeezed vegetable juice and a trough-sized helping of organic oatmeal, he says wrestling nearly destroyed his body.
I tore this shoulder. I have had operations on both knees. I ruptured my L4 and L5. My 5th, 6th, and 7th, they wanted to shave down and fuse. I wasn't doing that.
For months, DDP was bedridden. His spirit dwindled, as well as his prospects for continuing a career in wrestling. But one day, his wife Kimberly, a yoga devotee, convinced him to try some gentle yoga postures to help ease his pain. It was not an easy transition for him.
It took me 9 months before I'd even try to learn how to breathe, right? I'm breathing... You know, and my wife's going, you can't breathe like that. You got to take some back. I can't do it. That's not me. I got a broken nose. I can barely breathe anyway. You know, but I made a million excuses. And finally, I said, Uncle, I'm going to learn how to breathe.
In addition to learning how to breathe properly, DDP also had to put aside his machismo long enough to focus on something he'd always looked at as a girly form of exercise. Maggie Hobson is a physical therapist and yoga instructor in Flagstaff, Arizona. She says this is a dilemma facing many men who are curious about learning yoga.
They're used to just thinking, oh, I can do anything physical with my body. This should be good. These men that are used to bench pressing 300 pounds discover that they can't hold their body weight up for 5 breaths, and they become intimidated on a number of levels, and all of it related to ego and competition.
Hobson says she prescribes yoga to many of her patients recovering from injury or surgery because it helps increase flexibility while building core strength at the same time. She says male athletes are generally the hardest sell.
The first principle of yoga is called ahimsa, and what it basically means is to be compassionate to your own body first. That is something that can be very foreign to athletes because they can't be compassionate to their body. They need to really push through, push on. People that are very athletic and very successful in an athletic endeavor usually have done so by living by the credo of no pain, no gain.
That credo is what nearly cost Diamond Dallas Page the use of his body. He credits yoga for his recovery and renewed vigor and for his latest literary endeavor. DDP has written a book on his own version of yoga called Yoga for Regular Guys, or YRG. It takes all the physical benefits of yoga and wraps them up in rock and roll packaging, including one tried and true tactic.
The first way to really get regular guys to do it was to have the hot-looking babes, and I call yoga babes. Yogis are very namaste. YRG is a little more TNA, you know. And I have a theory that regular guys don't tell other guys that they do yoga, not only because they don't want to say the name, but they also don't want the other competition in the class. You know, that's where all those girls are getting fine shape or on their way to being in fine shape.
DDP's book is chock full of spandex-clad yoga babes demonstrating postures with names any regular guy can remember, like the touchdown position, the catcher's position, and the porn star. But Page doesn't rely completely on the miracle of silicone sculpture to sell his book. Also featured are pictures of guys with beer bellies and hairy backs demonstrating the same postures, proof that just about any regular guy can do DDP's brand of yoga at any age.
Flexibility is youth. When you were a kid, you fell down, you bounced right up, you went, kept going. Now you fall down, you go, oh my God, oh, I think I broke my hip. So what you're trying to do is hold back the hands of time.
DDP is doing a pretty good job of that himself. He'll turn 50 this year, and though he's moving away from wrestling to pursue movie projects with the likes of Rob Zombie and Snoop Dogg, he still wrestles occasionally for pay-per-view events. He says he never would have been able to get back in the ring if it weren't for yoga.
I took off 3 years, but I came back to work for TNA, and I wrestled against a guy named Raven, who's a buddy of mine. So we're going to pretty much beat the hell out of each other, you know, and we're going to go. And he'd been wrestling the whole time through, but twice during that match, he went, D, slow down, you're blowing me up. And I was like, man, screw you, dude, we're going. I'm just came back after 3 years off. You should be in better shape, you know. And after the match, he says, you must be like living on that Stairmaster. I said, dude, I haven't been on a Stairmaster, a bike, or a treadmill in 3 years. He said, how are you doing this? I said, YRG.
It looks like he's measuring Raven.
For Only a Game, I'm Jillian Ferris-Cole in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Look at this! Wait a minute! Yeah! Diamond Cutter by DDP! And he hits it right around and the crowd goes crazy!
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Kevin Griffin at WHYY in Philadelphia and from old friends Michael Garth and Mitch Tyke. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to listen to stories past and present, sign up for our newsletter or learn more about this golfing life. Michael Bamberger's, not mine. Please, visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from the guy responsible for writing the subtitle for This Golfing Life. Oh, no wonder there's no subtitle. He's shy. I definitely will not quote him in my upcoming book, The Explosion of the Lengthy Subtitle in 21st Century Publishing, subtitled Why You Need Lots and Lots and Lots of Words Following a Book Title in Order to Make the Book Sell to People Who Aren't Sufficiently Moved by Short, Simple, Moderately Provocative Prose. Whew, I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. From NPR member stations. From the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National